Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome everyone to Hidden Growth Champions, our podcast series. Today we're sitting at our offices, so this is the first podcast conversation we're having in a while in a physical space. We've all had them on Zoom far away, all hidden in our home offices and elsewhere. And this is the first time we're back at our offices in a physical location and having a conversation today with Colin Brown. Colin, welcome to our offices in person. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you, Sar. And it's a new one for me too, this, I have to say. It's a bit of an exotic experience to actually be out of the house and sitting inside an actual office space. Thank you for having me on this. It's very, very cool, very exciting. My name's Colin Brown. I'm the founder of an organization called Happy Sandpit, which is a kind of a consultancy, a training organization in the areas of organizational culture, employee engagement, leadership, and the intersection of those sorts of things. We've done quite a lot of research over the course of the last nearly a decade now, actually, just learning how organizations deal with these things and what some of the hallmarks are of organizations that get this stuff right, and what the hacks and shortcuts are to doing it. And of course, what some of the roadblocks and natural challenges that we have to get out of the way and get over ourselves in order to achieve great employee engagement. The ultimate outcome isn't just happy workspaces with smiling people, which is a nice thing, but better companies, right? I mean, it's got to have a purpose.
Absolutely. And Colin, we met for the first time about 2.5 years ago, because we invited you in to essentially help us write something that was bumping in our head, something that we called our manifesto, something that was not just a purpose statement or a set of values that we just wanted to talk about or share with the world. We really got a sense that there's something really unique here, that we're building a great business. So we asked you to come and share with us your simulation. You put us on the Titanic. You asked us to make some real decisions. We didn't like some of those decisions, but we had to make them. And I think in the process, we learned a lot, firstly, about the story of Titanic. That was fascinating. We've learned a lot about how taking ourselves out of our heads and practicing something different, in this case, through a simulation, really helped us to discover what we truly believe in, why we felt we had a great business, why did we feel we've got something we can shout out to the world. And ultimately, you and I conspired to give the team some homework, and we came back a week later, and we had a document that we called the manifesto. And I must tell you, I must commend you on this. I mean, this is a document more than any other document that we've ever created, more than our executive profile, more than our website, more than, you know, value propositions, a one pager on this or that, that we develop from time to time.
Yeah.
This is the document that we send to clients, to partners, to people who want to work with us, for us. It's the first document that lands in the inbox. And I've only had really positive and authentic responses to it.
So I'm delighted to hear it. So I'm glad that's really cool.
Yeah. Excellent. Colin, I just wanted us to kind of dial back a little bit into the kind of environment in which we are working in, all of us now, the kind of environment we're trying to make sense of. We can call it the recovery if I was an economist, and some are very bullish on the recovery and some are less so. I could say we're still in the midst of a pandemic because we're not fully vaccinated, and our plans to what we think the world of work would look like coming out of this has various views to it. But if I had to ask you, as we emerge from, as we are creating a rich picture of what the world of work would look like post the pandemic, the world that we're all building in our heads, practicing at the same time, discussing between us.
Yeah.
Give us a bit of a picture of how you've approached this really fundamental question.
I mean, I think we've always had the view, I've always had the view that organizations are smarter than they know they are. That if you were to take an organization of, it doesn't matter, even if you've got 10 people, I mean, many, of course, have thousands of people. There's loads and loads and loads of good brains in those organizations. And if you were able to stick a pipe into everybody's head and have one giant brain, which I'm pretty sure is illegal, but if you were able to do that, there probably isn't anything you don't know how to solve. In other words, the intelligence that resides inside organizations is massive, but it's almost always hidden. And the normal response to that prior to the last year has been, you know, we occasionally dip in, we occasionally try and include people in decision-making, probably at a much smaller level. We occasionally do these things, but fundamentally there are no smart mechanisms, there's no underlying philosophy about trying to find out what it is that we know. And I think organizations should first and foremost treat themselves as the business schools that they should go to learn, because it's not just theoretical stuff. It's the stuff that's specifically about us and about our culture. I think over the course of the last year, that was accelerated simply because, or it should have been accelerated. There was an opportunity lost if it wasn't, because for the first time ever, any of the reticence to do this had gone out the window. What might have sort of inspired reticence in the past is a sense that leaders are supposed to have the answers. But this time around, nobody did. And nobody could rightly be expected to ever have them either. It was okay for the first time ever to say, I don't know. And I think, and we found this in a range of organizations, not nearly enough, unfortunately, that organizations that have kind of gone, the solutions to our problem right now reside within the organization. We need to get more deeply involved in finding out what we know. Those have actually come up with much more practical solutions for how to reform, reshape business, be it ways of work, be it, you know, times and places of work, be it processes, whatever it might be, to actually shape those to accommodate this new alien thing, this strange new dynamic.
So one of the things that you've said that I just wanted to maybe amplify a little bit is you spoke about the pandemic has accelerated it. It's made it perhaps more visible. It brought us to our attention. We had to respond to it much more at scale and at speed. But these changes were already taking place. Organizations were struggling with bringing the best out of their own thinking, out of their own problem-solving ability into the world before that, whether they were tackling climate change, whether they were understanding how digital technologies could change their core processes, whether they were trying to envision what the ecosystem around their organization, whether it's in financial services, in retail, or in other industries could look like. These problems haven't gone away. It's simply that essentially it got amplified. It became more visible. Our ability to say, no, let's not look there. Let's not try a different approach. Let's not have the conversation.
Yeah.
Became smaller. So we had more of that conversation, right?
I think there was always a sense that, you know, you cram before an exam, but there was no real exam coming. And so no matter what happened up until now, nobody had to study quickly for an exam because there wasn't an exam on the horizon. So we've got time to push these things out. I mean, arguably, we haven't, but that's kind of been the mindset, that we've got time to push these things out. And so, yeah, even just if you think about the massive acceleration in the use of digital technologies, even basic digital technologies like video conferencing and that kind of thing, and collaboration tools, even basic things like that, we've always had the ability to use those things more extensively. Mm-hmm. We've always had the ability, therefore, to create a more of a remote working environment and resolve any number of issues that we've had. We just haven't had the pressure of a looming exam, right? We haven't had the pressure of a looming deadline. Mm-hmm. Suddenly the deadline came right at us, and it wasn't, okay, you got a couple of weeks to prepare. It was, hey, it's today. And suddenly the scramble was hectic. I think most organizations approach this, overwhelmingly, I think, approach this with a little bit of panic and a little bit of sort of overreaction, but that's to be expected.
Sure.
And I think over the course of it, a lot of organizations began to figure out what might work best, what might not work best. The thing is, though, Sar, I think there's so many unanswered questions here. I think, for example, I've said this so many times over the last few weeks, I keep reading about companies that claim they had their best year yet, or that, you know, our employees really brought through the numbers, or they knocked it out of the park, or productivity was through the roof. I keep hearing about all of that, but I wonder how many of those organizations have any sense of the price that was actually paid in order to achieve that. Because I don't think it was a normal price, and therefore I don't think it's sustainable. It didn't suddenly get good. Hey, remote working is brilliant. It all works and we get great performance. Let's go with it. You're missing the point about what actually happened last year. The fear was real. The dislocation was real. The strangeness of it was real. And so the overreaction was real. And that's not sustainable. That's not something we can simply mimic and do again this year. We've got to think about this again. And actually, I think we probably have to think about it deeply, maybe for the first time ever. All we did up until now was we erected a tent encampment after a hurricane hit. And we did this because people didn't have roofs over their heads, and it's better to keep them organized, keep them dry, keep them safe. And if they're organized in a certain way, we can distribute first aid and food. But this was never intended to be permanent. This was never intended to be a permanent solution. The problem is it's starting to become permanent, and there isn't an answer to it.
Yes.
You know?
And I think you've alluded to this, and the fact that we still need to solve real challenging problems out there, despite our difficulty of connecting, working away, in the title of the book that you're writing.
Right.
So maybe tell us a little bit about that. The title itself just captured me, and I wanted to know more.
Okay. Well, thank you. I mean, so the book's called "So You Opened an Office in Yemen, Now What?" Okay. And obviously it's got nothing to do with Yemen. Yemen's metaphorical. It's this strange place which you've probably heard of, but about which you probably know basically nothing. And I think that's probably true for most people. So this doesn't have anything to do with Yemen per se, but it has something to do with this real place about which we now have to try and like understand some stuff, because we just opened an office there. And the Yemeni offices in this case are the 2.5 billion branch offices that opened last year in people's living rooms, dining rooms, if people were lucky, in their office space at home. Most people didn't really have a home that was optimized for working anyway. And so it's partly about a new physical reality, a new geographical reality. It's also about a metaphysical reality. It's about a philosophical reality, which is that, you know, we started talking about working from home early in the year, and round about the middle of last year, we at least started talking about working while at home as opposed to working from home, because it wasn't just a geographical change. Mm. It was a very significant overlap of work and life. It was a very significant overlap of home and work. It was a very significant overlap of people, of a variety of different things, none of which were easily ignored, all of which were incredibly distracting, and all of which had the ability to create enormous stress. And this led us to thinking that there has to be a variety, like a whole range of different things, different approaches that need to be examined here. A whole range of approaches need to be examined. I mean, so for example, in the work from home analogy, which is it's just a geographical change,
yes,
working hours don't change, work commitments don't change, none of these things change. And all you do is you just get on with your job, and it's the same computer, it's the same software, it's a different chair, everything's fine. In the reality, however, there are 50 other competing things that are challenging for your time, challenging, that are creating distractions. Some of those are external: kids, homeschooling, the inefficiency of a work environment. Some of them are work related, the lack of real collaboration, the overuse of video technologies, and all of this kind of stuff, which, you know, we never learned to do meetings well, for example. We never really acknowledged that it's okay to have 5-minute catch-ups. We somehow block off time. And some of it's related to the sheer psychological impact of not actually being part of a team anymore. And a lot has been spoken about the difficulty of leading remote people. But being a remote person, I think, is something that's gone vastly underanalyzed. The very reason that people have put in 17 hours a day, the very reason they're not shutting off and all of that, is because of these deep psychological impacts that's happening to people. The sense of imposter syndrome, for example, is through the roof. It's a sense that in a previous environment, I could be seen every day by my boss, and in that acknowledgement, there is some sense that I've earned my place here. Now there isn't any. There's no sense of that whatsoever. In fact, if I don't somehow overperform to prove my worth, I don't necessarily know that I'm being noticed at all.
Yes.
And so we have this looming new pandemic of burnout, you know, that's about to happen if we don't address this very quickly. Mm. So you know, within this, there's a massive amount of rethinking that has to be done, a massive amount of recalibrating in terms of how we work, you know, what it is we're expected to achieve, what's a reasonable measurement for people at work. I don't think time on the job is it anymore. Mm. I think that's probably broadly acknowledged, but how we actually address that isn't necessarily, there's a brilliant, perfect answer to that yet.
Well, that's really interesting, because the domain in which there isn't a perfect answer yet brings out, I think, an important word for this conversation, which is innovation.
Right.
In a world where we did have a perfect answer, we may not have called it perfect. We called it benchmarked. We called it comparative. We called it the best organization, the champions of this or that. We could always refer and say, well, they do it like this. Could we do more of that? Could we do some of that?
Yeah.
And in our environment, it would look like this. And therefore, we put people into cubicles. We ask them to attend a series of meetings, et cetera, et cetera. The minute we acknowledge that we can't actually go back, the future won't look the same as the past, and this is just this recovery process we need to go through, and we need to start searching for different answers. And the place I found it the most over the last couple of days was triggered by a McKinsey article that was shared around the recovery in African banks.
Right.
It was really interesting because it spoke about banks across Africa in under various scenarios needing to improve operational efficiencies by 20 to 25% in order to get to pre-COVID profitability numbers, return on equity in particular. Sounds fascinating, but the one word that was missing throughout this article, one vague mention, just one, was innovation.
Right.
And what was missing for me there, and I'll bring it back to the world of work just now, is... So if I don't know what our innovation growth gap is, if I don't know how far I can solve this problem using existing means, existing technologies, existing ways of working, how can I go about innovating? I might be working under the delusion that all I need to do is engage my people better, or perhaps ask them to come into the office 2 times a week. How do I know that is sufficient for us not to fall into another year in which there's significant burnout,
yeah,
where people say, I can't cope with this anymore,
yeah,
where people stop innovating, where people just say, well, I'm just going to try and cope the best I can. So for me, there's a deeper problem here that we're trying to solve for. Is not just answering the question, what would the world of work look like? What is that answer? But being curious enough and asking, what are the questions that are worth posing?
Yeah.
What is the system that we need to change in order for people to be able to, into the future, work productively?
Yeah.
And it may be not more of what I did so far. I just need to remember to engage people better.
Yeah.
Or I need to remember, you know, to recognize people for their efforts better. Maybe that's not what people are looking for.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not enough anymore.
Yeah.
Because we're not going back to the 20-25% efficiency improvement by looking at 2018 or 2019, that's
correct,
not going to help us.
Correct.
It's not going to help African banks. It's not going to help banks throughout the world. It's certainly not going to help you and I when we try to work in a new environment going, yeah, forward.
No, you're right. And I think this is the thing. I think for too many organizations, the questions just haven't been asked yet. So it's not even that the questions haven't been answered. They haven't actually formulated them. A lot of them have been hanging around just waiting for this to blow over so we can go back to normal. And then this realization has come along that normal isn't really available to us anymore, and that actually it perhaps wasn't all that desirable in the first place. I mean, it came with its own ridiculous constraints, right? I mean, things like having a whole group of people, you know, all rushing to gather in one place over the course of sort of 8 hours, and then all, yes, rush away to come back and gather the next day. There are some things that are good about that, right? I mean, there's potential for a high degree of collaboration. Didn't always happen, unfortunately. What, yeah, tended to happen was silos, right? I mean, large organizations were particularly good at that. They're creating these sorts of silos across which there was no collaboration anyway. And so none of that actually has been lost. We're deluding ourselves when we tell ourselves it was there. In organizations where it was, I imagine that's probably quite a desirable outcome, is to try and get people back together again as much as possible. But we've got to decide, first of all, what it is that we've lost, and was it worth losing? Mm. You know, and realistically, have we lost it, or have we improved it? Have we kept it the same? And is it worth having? Mm. You know, and all of those sorts of things. So if you think about the standard norms that took place in a physical environment, the standard norms were operating hours, for example. And we've chosen these operating hours because our clients are there, and also because companies shape themselves to be exactly like each other, right? It's the fairly normal arc of an organization. An entrepreneur leaves a company and goes off to start something, all full of idealism, all full of great ideas about what it's going to look like. But when they look back a decade later, they formed a fairly standard sort of business with standard customer service policies, standard HR policies, standard operating hours, et cetera, et cetera. You're even using the same fingerprint recognition people on the front door as the company you used to work for. It's amazing how quickly we drift towards the norm, simply because we lose sight of the fact that we think our output is what we are there to do. You know, the product that we produce, the service that we deliver, and we forget that actually the collection of people that we are is a better focal point for us. The outputs then become much more predictable. They become much greater. In the physical environment, those were some of the normal constraints that we actually put in place and some of the things that we did, and we never questioned why. Mm-hmm. Now, in a non-physical place, and I know that remote working isn't entirely a non-physical place, but in this environment, are working hours, normal things like that, are they actually a requirement in order for us to achieve our objectives? I mean, all of a sudden, we've actually created a certain amount of freedom for people to be able to operate at their peak, at their best, and, yes. and do the things, you know, in their own way without being disruptive to other people. Because it was disruptive. If you work best between 3 a.m. and, you know, 9 or 10 a.m. or whatever, that's your best time. In a physical working environment, that was disruptive when people are coming in or they're not there or they're not part of the team. But if we are now focusing on the outputs, focusing on the deliverables instead of on the, you know, the actual bums on seats and all of that, we free ourselves from certain constraints. There are things we can tap into there. There are benefits we can get from that if we start to ask those sorts of questions.
Yes.
And I think the questions haven't been written for a lot of organizations yet. I think they've just been biding time.
Mm. If I had to ask you when you work with organizations, and as you go through the thinking process of what metaphorically opening up an office in Yemen might involve, what kind of level of innovation you need to engage in, there's no rule book, right, that says opening an office in Yemen 1, 2, and 3. What are the kinds of questions or even lessons perhaps
yeah.
that you would like organizations to keep in mind? Because as you said, it is about the questions, right?
Yeah.
There is no manual that you can throw at them and say, just do what I did.
Yeah.
What are the kind of lessons, though, that as they go through this journey, as they're thinking about their unique proposition of a post-COVID world,
yeah.
what does that mean for the world? What does it mean for their people and their well-being?
Yeah.
What are the kind of things that you want to leave with them?
So some of the things, some of the things to bear in mind, sir. I mean, the metaphor that as it came to me was that if you were to open an office in Cleveland, and you've already got an office in Cincinnati, or in New York, or in Los Angeles, for that matter. If you were to open an office in Melbourne, and you've already got one in Sydney, if you were to open one in London, and you've already got one in Brussels, and one in New York, I mean, there are so many similarities between the way Western operations work. They're not identical, but they're quite similar. But we're assuming a great deal. We've tried to put together these vast multicultural organizations. We've tried to do that. But those multicultural organizations have now kind of divested into individual little pockets of very concentrated cultural, you know, sort of mindsets, very, very sort of concentrated ways of work, ways of thinking, et cetera. And part of the job of trying to create sort of diverse and inclusive organizations in the past has been to try and get the most out of those. But actually what we've largely done prior to this and before organizations even focused on that was just try and push people down to be a similar way in the most basic way possible. Mm. Now, if you were to open an office in Yemen, the playbook from New York, from London, from Sydney, from Johannesburg isn't going to work terribly well there. It just... people are different there. The way they think there are different there. And we need to understand what the distractions are, what the potentials are. We need to understand, you know, the most constructive ways of working there are what? We can't just say it's 9 to 5 and you'll be in the office every day. And this is the software that you will use. And this is the way you will address customers. And these are the dress codes. And these are all of these sorts of things. We can't just say that this is the sort of the way in which we're going to go out and approach customers. And this is the way we're going to deal with them. And this is the expectation at the end. We can't say that this is the normal cycle of operation. So many things about that just won't work. We'll try and force it along, and we'll get what we've always had, a moderately successful way of doing things that needs an excessive amount of management in order to achieve it. Hmm. And if you want the best out of that office in Yemen, you're going to have to give it a degree of autonomy, which means you're going to have to understand how it best operates in order to deliver its best, you know, its best results. Now, extrapolate that. Have 2.5 billion offices in Yemen. There's a lot for us to understand there. It is going to be no good whatsoever having a blanket set of policies or processes. I'm not suggesting, by the way, I'm not suggesting anarchy. I'm not suggesting we do away with policies and processes and have none of those. That's not where I'm at. I think it becomes It becomes a much different thing, though, when we're hiring people that we perhaps will never meet. Mm-hmm. We're hiring people that we'll perhaps never physically see. And we're choosing people to work with. We're going to have to ask very different questions about that, which means we need to be very clear about, at the root, what it is that we live and die by. What are the things we absolutely cannot let go of? What are the things that are much more flexible to us? And the flexible list is going to be a much longer one than it's ever been before.
Just thinking, as you were describing this, there are a number of examples in history, in the world of work, where we were challenged to do something similar. It wasn't an office in Yemen, but it was a different way of working. I'm thinking of a wonderful book written in the 1970s, in fact, called One from Many, and it's a story of Visa. It's a story of how what became a credit card organization actually started.
Yeah.
And it was started by the realization that no one single bank, even Bank of America at that stage, which was a dominant force in U.S. banking, could in fact unleash the number of credit cards and associated merchant infrastructure, et cetera, onto the market. So they ended up, the person who set up Visa, essentially what became Visa, ended up spending a year within Bank of America with a very explicit set of principles of how he would operate, with the express intention of hiring himself and creating this new organization, which is exactly what he did.
Right.
And it became an organization based on principles of how various banking institutions and other players would interact with one another. There wasn't a single controlling entity.
Yeah.
So why am I raising it as an example? Is for me it's an interesting corollary. It's an interesting example of how we had to challenge our own assumptions of how things need to be done. And by doing that, we started asking very interesting questions. We moved from how would I be able to issue in those days 100,000 credit cards, which was almost unimaginable logistically at that time, and spread them across 50 states across the US, to something more deeper, like, could we create an organization where central authority does not necessarily need to dictate everything, where cohesion happens not because we've put it or coded it into a policy, but through other means? And by no means did Visa suddenly create the textbook for every organization around the world, but it taught us to ask some very, very interesting questions.
Yeah.
We started to examine some deeper questions here, which went, because they didn't solve the initial problem, they didn't manage to find a way of sending 100,000 credit cards by mail securely across the US in a 3 or 4 month period. It got done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Even that required some innovation, but it got done. And then they started getting curious about what else could we do?
Yeah.
So it's just interesting how we're able to move beyond
the
immediate problem we're trying to solve, which may be opening an office in Yemen or sending 100,000 credit cards by mail in the 1960s.
It's always made me laugh, you know. I mean, you talk about, we've become KPI obsessed inside organizations, right? And I think that there's like, again, I reiterate, I'm not an anarchist. I'm all in favor of measurement. I think you'd have to be insane to suggest that this isn't a necessity for a strong and productive organization. But the thing about it is, I think by and large, you know, if you were to examine KPIs, the majority of them aren't K at all, right? Mm. Half of them aren't even I. They're just P rather. They're just indicators. I mean, we don't require them at all. Not really. Not in order to get. And I think a lot of these things were linked to the fact that we are trying to create almost a copycat atmosphere from organization one organization to another. You have to be really, and you are considered to be maverick, and everybody knows your name if you stand up and do something radically different. But I don't think it's helped us necessarily. I think this is what's created much of a same-ish customer experience. Mm. Now, a really maverick organization in this particular instance might be one that considers a new model for leadership. That might be one that says leaders, managers who lead and manage are redundant, that actually these are support staff for leaders of the organization who are the people who are out in front. And how we define leadership going forward, which is right on the front end of the organization, mm-hmm. we might have to be a little circumspect in terms of how much power we enable people to exert, to exercise initially. As we grow in confidence and as we begin to understand, we can start to sort of flex our muscles in this area a little bit. But right now, the complexity of trying to manage a bunch of remote people, well, how about we don't do that at all then? How about we allow them largely to be self-managing? And I realize I'm talking about a slightly radical step here, but we allow them to be largely self-managing. We rewrite the KPIs to indicate a more leadership role for people, as opposed to a specific delivery role for people. Even though they still have their delivery metrics, there's a requirement for innovation. There's a requirement for them to think about improvement. There's a requirement for them to move the dial forward, even if it's just 1% per quarter, in order to improve the organization through this way that we're all trying to figure out. In other words, we're not having a central band of eight people in the middle of the company trying to figure this out. We farm that out and we say, you guys are out there doing it. You tell us how this needs to look. And then the management and leadership structure is all about, you know, it's the foundations under a building, right? I mean, there's this interlocking solid thing that enables the building to be in the first place. Mm. That takes a massive philosophical shift. Yes. It takes the need to control things away, and it takes away the need to constantly manage only by KPIs and manage a lot more instinctively, and be a lot more flexible and a lot more reactive as a leader, which is, you know, in the normal way of working, in the old way of working, that would have been considered a disastrous idea. In this way of working, I think it might be maverick.
Mm. Colin, this was a fascinating conversation. I'm sure we can be here for another hour delving into more chapters of your book, but we need to give you the opportunity of completing the book first.
Thank you.
Thank you for making the time to be here in our offices. Thank you for the conversation. I'm sure this would resonate with many people out there who listen. And let's keep on striving to become the mavericks in this process.
It's a brave new world ahead, Sar. So let's see how it all turns out. Thank you very much for having me.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.